I'm Nick Zeppos, Chancellor of Vanderbilt University. Welcome to the Zeppos Report, a podcast where I talk with the people shaping and helping us understand our world. My guest today is Sally Yates, former acting U.S. Attorney General under the Trump administration and Deputy Attorney General for the Obama administration. Sally served in the Department of Justice for over 27 years, beginning with a stint as an assistant United States attorney in her hometown of Atlanta, Georgia. On her last day in office, she ordered the Justice Department not to defend the Trump administration's controversial executive order that banned citizens of seven Muslim-majority countries from entering the United States. Sally was with us last night visiting Vanderbilt to address our community about the rule of law in the presidency. She is joining me today to continue that discussion. Sally, welcome to the Zeppos Report.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege to be here.
So we were talking a little bit about your path to the law, and when did people start to say to you, you should be a lawyer? Did you kind of think of it?
You know, I come from a long line of lawyers on both sides of my family. My father, both of my grandfathers, my uncle, my cousin, even my grandmother was a lawyer. She was one of the first women admitted to the Georgia bar. Wow. But did not go to law school. This was back in the day where you could read law under another lawyer. And she did and immediately passed the bar exam. But, you know, this was a long time ago in the South, and she couldn't get a job practicing law then. And she was then the secretary for my grandfather and later for my father and uncle. But truth be told, she was smarter than any of them.
Sure.
She was certainly paving the way there for me.
Yeah, my father-in-law was a lawyer. He was also a public official. He was a mayor of Springfield, Illinois. And my mother-in-law, Mary, she didn't go to law school, but when he left office, they worked together. And I would tell my wife, Lydia, I said, your mom's a really good lawyer. I mean, he's writing wills and doing deeds and... Well, let me talk to you a little bit about going into the United States Attorney's Office. Mm-hmm. How did you make the decision that was really the sort of career you wanted? What attracted you to being an AUSA?
Well, you know, I have to confess, when I was in law school, I had no thought at all about becoming a prosecutor or really even practicing criminal law. I went to a big firm after I got out of law school and had a really good experience there, but really wanted to do work that I felt like was more meaningful, that was having a greater impact. And so I thought I would try the U.S. Attorney's Office, having absolutely no idea how captured I would become by the work and the mission there. And it was almost immediately when I got to the U.S. Attorney's Office and got to experience the luxury of always believing that I was on the right side of the case. Mm. I mean, you know, you're a lawyer, you know, you represent your client's interest, but in the U.S. Attorney's Office, I felt like we were really doing work that mattered. It, you know, wasn't Mother Teresa's work, but it was work that mattered. And my plans of going back to private practice after a few years, I continued to put that off year after year and found myself 27 years later still part of DOJ.
When you were appointed United States Attorney and then through your career, you know, how has being a woman shaped, affected, or made you think of your role, obviously first as a representative of the United States, but also as a role model for others?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I first started practicing, I graduated from law school in 1986. There were, you know, a fair number of women in law, but there weren't that many female litigators.
Right.
I remember at our firm, there were very few women in the litigation department. And then when I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office, there were more women in the civil division than the criminal division. That certainly evolved over time. I was the first woman to be appointed United States Attorney in Atlanta in the Northern District. And then when I became Deputy Attorney General and I was serving then under Loretta Lynch, who was the Attorney General, at the end of a meeting we were having in her conference room one day, my principal deputy, Matt Axelrod, turned to me and said, "Did you realize I was the only man at the table during this meeting?" And truth be told, I had not even noticed that. So that tells you just over the course of that 25 years, from when there were very few women in the litigation department to we're sitting at the Attorney General's conference room table and there's only one man there. That's a pretty big change during that period of time.
When you were one of the United States attorneys who came to the White House and to be greeted by President Obama, were there a number of other women?
Yes.
I know Mary Jo White, obviously some high profile.
No, there was, you know, I should know what the exact numbers were. There are 93 U.S. attorneys. Yeah. I don't know that it was half and half, but it wouldn't have been far off of that. That was one thing that the Obama administration really emphasized was diversity, not just gender, but diversity across the board, and particularly at the Department of Justice, where it's really important that DOJ be a reflection of the people that we served.
Right, and talk a little bit about that. DOJ is, you know, we are asking you to enforce the law, to many times interpret the law, sometimes to decide to bring a case, not bring a case. It's kind of shot through with discretion in ways that people, I think, increasingly are understanding. You know, we as a university really thrive from our diversity, that people from different countries, different faiths, different socioeconomic backgrounds, different races are coming together with very different experiences and perspectives, kind of then coming together as a community to say, well, this is what Vanderbilt does.
Right.
So it's kind of really the ultimate e pluribus unum. Mm-hmm. We're pluralistic, but we have this university mission. How did you think of diversity in your role as a law enforcement officer?
Well, I think it goes back to what I mentioned a moment ago, both on a grand national scale, but also on the more direct on the ground scale as well. For example, when I was United States Attorney, ensuring that the AUSAs that we were hiring reflected the district was a really, really important thing for us for a few reasons. One, we really needed the perspective of people from different backgrounds, different races, different genders, different nationalities, to be able to help us to assess what our priorities were going to be. You know, we have very limited resources on the federal side. And so you have both the luxury to choose your cases, but also the responsibility to do it in such a way that you have the greatest public safety impact in your district. So you really need that diverse perspective in making that decision. But also, when you are trying cases and when members of the public come in as jurors and they see the assistant United States attorney, the representative of the people standing there in court, to me, it was really important from a public confidence standpoint that they see a broad spectrum. It can't be all white males that are there representing the people because we're not a country of all white males.
Right, and I think we have a jury system, and the jury's going to go back and decide what they think is the law and fair and just. So I think it's essential that we reflect our country in so many of these areas of law enforcement and in serving our communities. Let me ask you a little bit about, we talked about this last night, kind of the travel ban, and then but I want to really also talk about the Dreamers and DACA. One of the things that is controversial is, and you see this in marijuana growing, and is the department has to decide what cases is it really going to bring. And that's a question of resources, but also public reaction to your priorities. How much of the Dreamers policy was humanitarian and, you know, kind of good for the country in terms of diversity and economics, but also just as a law enforcement officer, you are, it's just not practical or caring to say, I am going to deport hundreds of thousands of people. We talk a lot about policies, but the rubber has to hit the road one time where, okay, now we're going to do this. Is it really practical to think of doing this in a fair, humane way that does not put the government in a position of disregard, but also take resources away from more important matters that you obviously saw pressing?
Right. You're absolutely right about that. The DACA decision was made before I came to Maine Justice. I was a U.S. attorney in Atlanta, so I was not part of that decision-making process and don't really have insight into precisely, you know, the factors that were considered there. But from the outside, I can tell you, and look at it, is virtually impossible with the resources that we have to deport every single person in this country who is here in an undocumented status. It doesn't exist. The resources aren't there. And so much like we do on the criminal prosecution side, you really have an obligation to look at, okay, how do we use these limited resources in a way that's going to make the communities most safe? And what that means is you go after the most dangerous people, or sometimes, for example, on the white-collar side, you use those resources in a way to protect people from being defrauded, and where we know that our state and local systems cannot and don't have the resources to address those things. Similarly, with respect to immigration, not only are there not the resources there to be able to deport everyone, those are not the people that are, the dreamers are not the folks that are causing problems here. It's you want to focus your resources on those people who are dangerous, who are committing crimes here. And that's what we were doing during the Obama administration, is trying to focus those limited immigration resources in the same way that we were focusing our prosecutorial resources. That just makes good public safety sense.
Right. If you told a U.S. attorney's office that you were going to drop hundreds of cases into their portfolio, some of which would spill, I guess, into the civil area, you just would say, well, here are the five areas that involve very dangerous, serious things for our communities and our country. You just should know we're not going to be able to do all that.
That's right.
Unless we hire 10,000 United States AUSAs or something.
And even if you did that, the court system couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
We're not set up for that. And that really requires us to impose a discipline and determining what's really going to have an impact and what isn't.
Right, particularly when you think of the docket that a federal district judge is going to see, and they will let you know as a U.S. attorney, why am I seeing all these sorts of cases? Did you get that sort of feedback from the judges on issues of sentencing and why are you bringing this case? How much did that affect you? I know you're getting directions from Washington about priorities as a U.S. attorney. How much did you see the judges say, I really don't understand why you have this case, or I don't like these sentencing guidelines? You know, they're going to follow the law, but when did they express frustration to you?
Well, certainly, you know, it's not a uniform group. You have judges there with different perspectives. And so there would be times when, actually it was a pretty small handful, would express their views to me when I was United States Attorney then about they might not understand why we were spending resources on this or that, or they thought we were seeking too much time, or some judges too little time for some of the individuals that we were prosecuting. And I would generally try to explain what our thinking was, how we were prioritizing. I would certainly take in what they had to say, but really there's a separation of powers
right there.
And I felt like it was the responsibility of the Department of Justice to determine how we were going to use those resources. Now, if I thought that that judge had a point, then that was certainly something I would take into consideration. But I tried as best I could to explain why we were doing what we were doing. And also importantly, during that time, as a result of Smart on Crime, which was Attorney General Holder's criminal justice reform initiative within the department to stop seeking mandatory minimum sentences against lower-level nonviolent drug offenders and to reserve those harsh sentences for those people who were truly dangerous, that actually addressed a lot of the concerns that had been raised by judges before, who were very troubled that they were being required to impose sentences of 20, 30, 40 years, sometimes even life, and had absolutely no discretion in that.
Yes, you worked within that kind of new system, but yet you never saw legislative reform, and we talked about this last night. It is a really tough thing to do for politicians, but were you hopeful at one point that it might happen, and why do you think it didn't?
I was incredibly hopeful. Some might say naive, yeah. But I was incredibly hopeful because, you know, we saw a real bipartisan consensus for sentencing reform. You know, you had everybody from the Koch brothers on the right and groups on the left that were coming together and recognizing that we really needed to recalibrate our sentencing structure for drug offenses. That is something, you know, we have watched the federal prison population explode by 800% since the 1980s, primarily as a result of drug defendants. And so all across the board, we saw a consensus recognizing that fiscally it was unsustainable to continue as we were, that from a fairness standpoint, that many of these sentences were really grossly disproportionate with the level of wrongdoing, and that it was also having a negative impact on public safety because dollars were being diverted to keep people in prison longer than they needed to be there, and consequently were not available for more important public safety initiatives. And so when you combine those three things, it was a remarkable thing that we had this bipartisan consensus, but yet we couldn't get a vote. And so, you know, unfortunately, the clock rolled, and we're now on to another administration. And certainly, it doesn't seem that sentencing reform is a priority of this Justice Department. We'll wait and see how it plays out over the entire 4 years. But I worry that we missed a window in time to really be able to bring about change that's essential for our system.
One of the aspects of a United States attorney's portfolio, when you say sometimes the states can't handle it, is political corruption cases. Mm-hmm. And you just see a lot of those cases have to be brought in federal court because the politics of the state, the state's attorney, is not going to usually bring a case. So what were political corruption cases like to investigate or decide on, or how did you approach those, given that there's the kind of federalism issue people would mm-hmm. talk about?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I did a lot of public corruption work when I was assistant United States attorney, really for over the course of 20 years when I was there. That was really the bulk of my work. And you're right, those are challenging cases. By definition, they are powerful people who are popular, or they wouldn't have been elected. And you don't make a lot of friends sometimes doing corruption cases. But we also realized that when it came to corruption cases, you're right, we were kind of the only game in town for a couple of reasons. One, United States attorneys are not elected. And so we didn't have that pressure to have to address. But we also have investigative grand juries in the federal system. And at least in Georgia, they don't have the same kind of investigative grand jury system. So we had tools that were available to us that they didn't have on the state side as well. I never worried too much about the federalism side and all the corruption cases I brought over the years. I never had a jury or a judge look at me and say, you know, Ms. Yates, this case really shouldn't be in federal court. We didn't do penny-ante little cases. But even if the bribe was small, that doesn't make the crime unimportant. That just means they could be bought cheap.
Right.
And, you know, when you're talking about the corruption of a system and a betrayal of public trust, you know, I think that's some of the most important work that the Department of Justice does.
How does that translate into, I don't want you to speak confidentially, or I'm not asking for a legal opinion, how does that play into an investigation of the Russian investigation that we have now? How does something like that proceed in an orderly way when you have so many news outlets and then you have a president who's unique?
Well, it is exponentially more difficult than, for example, the investigation of a local official. You know, I would feel when we were in Atlanta and we were doing local corruption cases, you feel the glare of local media and local attention who are watching every step you take, not just at trial, but during the investigation. And one of the things I used to tell our lawyers there is they need to recognize that if that case goes to trial, it's not just the defendant who's going to be on trial. It's going to be the government, too, and how we went about doing that investigation. And so it's important in every case that we did things the right way. But it was going to play out. So they needed to make sure that every step they took was one that the public would perceive as fair, not just legal, but fair. And so now you take an investigation that reaches into the White House itself. And in a very volatile environment where you have the President of the United States making very direct comments and criticisms of that, you pretty much have to just batten down the hatches and keep looking straight ahead and do your job and call it like you see it. You can't be responding to that kind of criticism or outside pressure. You have to make sure that everything you're doing is by the book and you're doing it the right way, that you're not jerking people around, but that you're also not being intimidated. And I have tremendous confidence in Bob Mueller and the people that he has working for him and am confident that he's going to do just that.
Yeah, I think the grand jury secrecy that you see is absolutely essential, and I think it gives the prosecutor space to just say, we do things this way, and if there's public debate or comment, this is all confidential.
Right.
And I think it's essential that it proceed that way to preserve the integrity of any sort of findings or investigation and the results of it. Let's go to the travel ban, and it's a big step for any attorney general to say, I will not defend a statute, I will not defend a regulatory decision, and I will not support the decision of the president. What are the key things that entered your mind when you made that decision that you just could not send your lawyers to defend this?
Well, you know, normally you wouldn't be in that posture because normally the Attorney General and others would have been included in the decision-making process to begin with. And so normally the AG would have an opportunity to give his or her opinion and views and advice before an executive order like that is signed. And so the good news is that this kind of situation doesn't come up very often. That was not the scenario that we were in. You know, we learned about it after the executive order had been signed. And so at that point, we didn't have an opportunity to give any input. It was a question of looking at, do we believe that this is lawful? Do we believe it's constitutional? And can we act consistently with the obligation of the Department of Justice in defending it? And after rapid but much consultation with others at the Department of Justice, I became convinced that we could not defend the executive order in a manner that was asserting a defense that was grounded in truth, that we would have to go in and argue that the executive order had absolutely nothing to do with religion, that it was purely a national security objective here. And against the backdrop both of the president's statements that he had made, both on the campaign trail and statements that had been made since he had been elected and statements of his surrogates, and against the backdrop of the absence of any kind of process seeking the input of national security experts, and in fact, those experts indicating that this travel ban would be counterproductive to a national security objective. And when you combine that with the fact we were talking about a fundamental core issue here of religious freedom, when you combined those things, I didn't see how there was any way that I could, in good conscience, send lawyers or the Department of Justice in to defend it.
I thought one of the most remarkable things, and you have to understand I'm an administrative lawyer, was the process that was used, mm-hmm. and that they never brought in the department or the national security agencies. And then I was talking to some of my alumni, and I said, they're now clarifying it through the White House counsel's office.
Yep.
And I said, you know, this is really arcane law probably, but the White House counsel is not an officer of the United States. I hate to tell you, it's Sally Yates is an officer of the United States. And you can't have the internal staff who are not appointed and confirmed by the Senate winging it and leave the department out of it. And I think the process that led to this substantive concerns that were just profound was just something that you never could imagine being done. I was telling somebody that I said, you know, this actually is what Roosevelt did in the first 100 days in the National Industrial Recovery Act. They just would issue these orders. No one saw them. And they weren't even printed. They weren't sent out. And so the process of government is deliberative. And I think we want action all the time and fast action, but yet our constitutional and governmental system is designed to be, you know, I would say fairly deliberative. Mm-hmm. And I think that to exclude the department and exclude the attorney general and then start to tell your counsel's office to issue advisory opinions is kind of beyond the scope of what our constitutional system really contemplated, considering the religious discrimination that lay at the heart of it. It was really quite a remarkable process.
Well, I think you're right. In fact, at the time I made my decision, it was the position of the White House that the travel ban applied to even lawful permanent residents, people who had lawful status here in the United States, and applied to visa holders, and with no procedural due process whatsoever here. I can't imagine that there's anybody who actually thinks that that's constitutional.
Right.
And then after I made my decision and I was no longer with DOJ, the White House counsel issued a memo. I think you may be referring to this saying,
yeah.
We've changed our
right.
mind. Now it doesn't apply to
that
lawful
just made
permanent
it worse
residents.
To me.
And in fact, one of the courts that struck down the travel ban said just that,
yeah.
that the White House counsel is not the president. And also, how do we know that they won't change their mind tomorrow?
Right. Right.
And so then, as you know, they withdrew the original travel ban and went to travel ban 2.
Right. And now we have travel ban
3.0.
3.0,
yes.
although it's very hard for me to keep track of.
Yeah.
On a college campus, we have a lot of different viewpoints. I know that people think otherwise, but you know, we are big believers in free speech. I don't think that means that anyone can come on your campus and kind of uninvited just march through with torches or whatever those things are. But yet, I think for a university, it's not just the vocal protest, but it's civil discourse and engagement. And so how do you think your experience teaches us about strong policy views, but in disagreement, being civil and being give and take with the possibility that people are actually listening to each other and changing his or her mind in a discussion? How much did your work overlap with what we really try to do here?
Well, you know, I think we govern best when we have a really robust exchange of ideas. I know, for example, when I was Deputy Attorney General and had a difficult decision to make, I didn't want somebody to come in and just make a recommendation to me. I really wanted to have an opportunity to hear the debate, the pros and the cons so that I then could ask my own questions and try to drill down on what was going to be the best answer. As a country, I think that's what's best too, that we be able to treat each other civilly and to be able to disagree on policies, but to respect the right of all of us to express our views. You know, the First Amendment isn't really necessary to protect somebody's views with whom you agree.
Right.
It's when you don't agree or when you find those views offensive.
Right. What, as somebody who has to be measured and thoughtful as an AUSA, as the United States Attorney, as Deputy Attorney General, and as Acting Attorney General, the one quality you have to have is there a calm person in the room when news hits? You wrote in the Times in a really brilliant op-ed that we risk becoming numb to the daily barrage of alarming news. How do we mitigate this risk, and then how do we respond to just the fusillade of all these stories that come out, and how do you as a leader think of, well, I'm sitting at a table, I'm responsible, here's how I'm going to respond to all of this, you know, news that's constantly coming out?
Well, I'm not going to pretend that I have the answer to that. I think that's a really difficult challenge that's facing our country right now. But when I wrote that, I thought, you know, it does seem that every single day almost there's something else that happens that in prior times we would have found absolutely shocking and would have been the topic of conversation for quite some time. And now whatever that disturbing thing might be is eclipsed the next day, it seems, with something else. And while I know that this is exhausting and you can't stay in a permanent state of outrage, at the same time, out of sheer survival, I worry that we start to normalize some of this conduct and that by just moving on through a 24-hour news cycle to the next thing, whatever it might be, the next day, that our psyche becomes such that even, you know, at the end of this administration, we think some of this stuff is normal when it's not. And so, you know, as for me, I've tried to identify those areas where I think I might have something specific to add and to speak out on those, not to be out there every single day expressing outrage over the events of that day. There are plenty of other people doing that. But beyond just leaders, I think as a country, it's really important that we not allow ourselves to become numbed by this and to think that some of these things that are happening is the way of our country, because I don't believe that it is.
I have two sons, and they're unusual in the sense that they are never interested in Facebook, Twitter, and...
How did you manage that?
I don't know. And then for a while, when my one son was in college, he wouldn't even have a cell phone, which I had to get cell phone numbers for all his friends. And
that's impressive.
Yeah. I'm thrilled that your daughter, Kelly, is a 2014 graduate, yet the millennials are perceived as needing, mm-hmm. I'm going to look at my Facebook account, I'm going to look at Twitter, and the statistics on how often a kid will look at a cell phone are really, you know, in many ways alarming to people. Mm-hmm. What do you tell your own daughter about these, you know, kind of the barrage and the almost the, you know, it's kind of supply and demand. Someone must be responding and liking this. When you're with college students or young professionals or law students, do you talk to them about how they spend their time with social media? And what would you say to them?
Well, to me, there's sort of two components to that, or two concerns that I would have. Is one, the amount of time, you're right, that you spend looking at your phone. And look, I find myself kind of guilty of it sometimes too, and try to discipline myself. Not so much on social media and all, but in reading news. And lose the ability to be able to have conversations with people. It's interesting to me how, you know, my kids don't really call people very much. They text instead. And so, you know, that's one social phenomena there. But with respect to news, you know, one concern is if you're getting all of your news through Facebook or other social media, that tends to give you a skewed view, sort of the echo chamber of news feeds, of stories that you've liked, and you get other stories like that. And I worry a little bit that our kids don't develop that critical thinking skill that they need to be able to examine news stories and to pressure test them for how true they actually are, or what the bias may be of the person who's writing it and who is the source. You know, an article posted on social media looks as legitimate as an article in the Wall Street Journal or New York Times to someone who's getting most of their news through social media. And I think that that's a real danger, not just for young people, but for everyone in our society now, that is sort of getting that constant news stream without that critical thinking to discern what's true and what's biased.
Right. It's interesting when we talk a lot with our students about social media, learning online, there's a strong resistance to it for the college experience. And I think adults looking in say, oh, these kids, well, they'll just stare at a computer. You can teach them that way. And every time we talk to our students about the machine versus the human, they want human. And they want small classes. They want to meet people and interact with them in real ways. And they want to listen to each other. And, you know, that's kind of how we as a university think about our work, which is it's maybe surprising, but that critical thinking and epistemology, how do you know what you know? And why do you think what you think? There's an incredible demand in our students for it, and it plays out in, you know, decisions we make about what to build, what to teach, how to teach, what the classes should be like. We had a very interesting experience. We built some. We're all the students really live on campus. We like that. We're building a, you know, really beloved community to learn and discover together. But we built two new residential colleges at the Kassam Quad, and there was this kind of, oh, kids grab and go. They don't really like to sit down. And I think, you know, all of us can think of our kids. It's like, hey, why don't you sit down for dinner? I'm going to grab something on the way. And we kind of bought into this. And then as we're building the new one, the students said to us, we want to eat together. And we want a dining hall. We want to sit together, and we want places to sit together. And, you know, at least in our little corner, it's a very little corner of the world, I'm seeing this thirst for learning and critical thinking and getting to know other people. And I think the challenge that, you know, you had and our country has is, well, if it works at our little Vanderbilt, can it really work, you know, in the Northern District of Georgia? Can it really work in the United States of America? And, you know, as you finish this part of your career, whatever path you choose, and we'd be interested in your thoughts, what path that might be, but how does that mission play into your next step?
Well, you know, my daughter had such a terrific experience here at Vanderbilt, I have to tell you.
Thank
that.
You.
And, you know, I think one of the real hallmarks of the college experience is exactly what you were describing there, that opportunity to engage with your professors, to have casual engagement with your colleagues and your classmates, but then the debate that goes on. I mean, those are formative years, I think, where students decide sort of who they are and what they believe in. And I personally don't think you can do that just sitting in front of a computer. So I'm glad that your students are telling you as well that they value that, that that's a real hunger that they have there. And, you know, one of the things I found as U.S. attorney is that, you know, we would go out into communities in the Northern District and doing prevention work and reentry work. And I remember a reentry program that I had in English Avenue at the Lindsay Street Baptist Church there. And it was for individuals who were coming out of state prison for us to connect them with service providers, whether it was, you know, alcohol treatment or drug treatment or housing or literacy for service providers so that they could have a better chance at being successful when they were out. And I noticed one day that there were a lot of people there that were not former inmates and learned that they were people from the neighborhood that were there because they couldn't believe that a prosecutor was doing this program, that they didn't understand why a prosecutor cared about what happened to these folks after they came out of prison. And I found that if you get out and you meet people and they're face-to-face with you, it's a lot harder to vilify somebody that you've actually met and had a conversation with. And as much as, you know, we do so much in writing these days or in social media, et cetera, there is no substitute for the face-to-face discourse. That's the only real opportunity, I think, that we have to get to know one another. And obviously, they can't all be one-on-one meetings, but even big group meetings like that, where you have a chance to look somebody in the eye and sort of take the measure of who they are and what they believe in, you know, that's essential, I think, to confidence in our institutions.
Yeah, I think doing the unexpected and becoming proximate with those that don't understand who you really might be and actually might have very legitimate beliefs that all the AUSAs care about is locking people up. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just even overwhelmed that you would, as a U.S. attorney, you know, go out in the community and say, you know, we want to be part of the solution to make your communities better. And I think that we so vilify what I call the other that we never sit down and, you know, get outside of ourselves and make even ourselves uncomfortable. I mean, because you know, as the United States attorney, you're going to be looked at like, okay, these are the folks that are putting all of our young men in jail for long periods of time.
Right.
And having the kind of compassion and courage to do that. And I think what's really, and I see it in Nashville, and you know, I've got to do a better job myself, but just oftentimes it's less than a mile away to go.
Right. And that was the case in Atlanta in the U.S. Attorney's Office. I could literally look out my office window and see the English Avenue area, which was one of our most challenged areas. But you know, one of the great things is that when we started this community outreach initiative in the office, it may have started with me doing it. By the end, we had a huge percentage of people in the office, lawyers and support and administrative people alike, who were out in our community in some type of prevention or reentry, whether it was reading in some of the schools in that area, doing reentry work. I mean, in the full range, and they loved it. I mean, I think it was a little weird at first to folks because sort of the idea is, wait a minute, this, you know, how is this really in our responsibility? But our job was not to put people in prison. Our job was to build a safer community. And I just so strongly believe that, you know, we're not going to jail our way into safer communities. It really requires effective prevention and reentry as well. And that as the Justice Department and the U.S. Attorney's Office, we needed to be a part of that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's when I think of you talking and you're part of the Department of Justice and the word justice is in the title.
Yeah. It's the only agency that's named for a virtue.
Yeah. And, you know, I even kind of laugh at some of the Supreme Court justices where it's like, Okay, well, you know, you do have a title called Justice. Mm-hmm. And so what, and we all have different flavors of it, but why don't we at least talk about what is justice for people? And I really commend you for having the holistic view and giving credence to the name of the department for which you led.
Well, you know, I think you'd find there are lots of people in DOJ that feel the very same way. And that's, you know, it's commonly said there, we're not the Department of Prosecutions.
Right.
We're the Department of Justice. And that means that fairness and balance and equal application of the laws has to govern every single thing. I keep saying we. I'm not we part of we anymore, but yeah, at the time.
I always say, listen, I mean, I tell my students, I've taught constitutional law for so many years, and what's the most important part of the Constitution? And I used to say this, and I'm now convinced it's we the people.
Right.
I mean, it's we the people. Mm-hmm. And the rights and the definition of those rights flow from we. So I think it is we.
And I think we at DOJ had a special responsibility there. It's not like the responsibility of any other lawyer. We weren't there just to represent our client. We were there to seek justice. And sometimes that means putting somebody in prison for a very long time. Sometimes that means not pursuing a case if it's not the fair and just thing to do. But it always means ensuring that we are handling the case, the manner, in a way that would engender the trust of the people that we're serving. We're playing not just by the rules, but we're doing the case in a fair manner, and that we're being proportional. That's where sort of sentencing reform comes into
right.
me and is so essential
over-incarceration
with the mission of the Department of Justice.
At all levels, too, at state and federal.
Absolutely. I mean, sort of a core responsibility there is not just to ensure that the innocent don't suffer, that only the guilty are convicted, but then that the punishment that is meted out is fair and proportional to the level of wrongdoing that's involved. To me, it's a cop-out to say, well, you know, they did the crime, now they got to go to prison for life. If life is really not a fair response to their wrongdoing.
A lot of people are encouraging you or speculating that you might run for public office. How would you think about making that decision, Sally?
Folks have been very kind, and I'm incredibly flattered that people would want me to run for office. It's no secret that I believe in public service. I wouldn't have stayed with the Department of Justice for as long as I did. And, you know, as I said last night, that's where my heart is. That's the work that I really believe in. But public service and running for public office, I'm not saying they're two different things, but I've just never felt that draw mm-hmm. to running for public office. I feel like most of the people that do that have kind of known their whole life that's what they wanted to do, and I've just really never felt that. So I hope that I'll be able to find another way to be able to continue to have an impact and maybe someday to have some other form of public service. But I'm having a hard time picturing running for office.
Well, Sally, thank you for being here today and for your enlightened and passionate service to our nation. It is an honor to host you at Vanderbilt. You can download this and other episodes of the Zeppos Report at vu.edu/Zeppos-report. vu.edu/Zeppos-report. Sally, it might be after this report, you may just by acclamation be elected to some office because you're really an American treasure. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been a privilege to be here today. Thanks so much for having me.